Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, so lead story here that I want to talk about is this past week, a few days ago, Trump apparently invites the China delegation, trade delegation, to come back to the U.S. to discuss and maybe avert a China-U.S. trade war. What's all this about? Well, a lot of pressure this past week levied on Trump from business groups and interests to avert a trade war. You know, so far they've only imposed $50 billion tariffs each, U.S. on China, China on the U.S., but Trump has in the wings another $200 billion on China. And then he even said, if necessary, I would add another $267 billion, so $467 billion of tariffs on China. Well, that would eliminate all China trade, all exports from China to the U.S. China, of course, does not import as much, only a little over $100 billion from the U.S., so it cannot do a tit-for-tat further tariff war with Trump in the U.S., and Trump is counting on that. Well, but the Chinese can do other things, you know. They could devalue, allow their currency to devalue and offset all the U.S. tariffs. China doesn't really want to do that, though. China's trying to establish its currency, the yuan, as a global currency and therefore wants to maintain stability. However, market forces are already devaluing the Chinese currency. As the U.S. dollar rises, naturally, the yuan must decline. And it has, over 10%. And it's bumping up against its band, the outer limits of its band. And if it goes any further in devaluation, then it will break the band, and that will have repercussions globally, as I've argued before. But I don't think China wants to do that. In fact, they're intervening in global money markets to prevent further devaluation. So now we're hearing all this nonsense about China manipulating its currency once again. That's all for public use, public consumption. They know it's not manipulating. If manipulating anything, it's trying to stabilize it. Okay, so China probably won't do that if Trump imposes another $200 billion. But they could make it very uncomfortable for U.S. companies in China. They could initiate among Chinese consumers, a boycott America, American companies, American goods, that would have a big negative effect. They could undertake other forms of actions as well, besides just tariffs. If Trump imposes $200 billion, then it truly will precipitate a trade war. You know, he's talked about it, he's lined up, but he hasn't actually implemented it. So far, only $50 billion has been implemented. At the same time, Trump has been pulling the plug on all of his threats and actions elsewhere with allies with regard to trade. It looks like they got a real sweet, soft deal here with Mexico, much like the Korean deal. A lot of talk, but no real action, tough action. And quietly, at the same time, Trump suspended or repealed his tariffs on all these other countries on steel and aluminum. Yeah, we didn't hear about that much. And then, of course, he came to a truce with Europe here. So everywhere else, this trade war is phony. Question is it really real with China? Oh, well, it's on the brink. And as I've said before, there's these three factions in the U.S. trade delegation. One faction is led by the bankers, Steve Mnuchin, Treasury Secretary, who want more access to China markets. And China has given it to them last May. Said, yeah, come on in. You can have more access. You can have 51% ownership. We may even give you 100% ownership of companies here. No more joint 49%. Oh, they love that. U.S. bankers love that. And then China even said, we'll buy $100 billion more of your farm goods. Ah, but the real stickler was technology. And the military-industrial complex in the U.S. and the intelligence spooks and so forth are worried about China's technology, particularly in the three key areas, artificial intelligence, cybersecurity, and 5G wireless, which have big military implications. And they've been doing everything they can since last May to prevent a deal that the U.S. bankers and farm interests want. Okay, so what did they do? Well, this ZTE Corporation, they threw a wrench into that. They're working through their friends in Congress, you see. The defense establishment working through through Congress. And whoever gets Trump's ear tends to pull him to their side. And Trump flipped over to the side of the military, you know, the Peter Navarros and the Robert Lighthizers. They're the inside men in the U.S. trade delegation here who are pushing for big limits on China technology development. That's what they want. It's military, you see. And it seems that Trump has flipped to their side. So why did he invite them to come back here? Well, did Trump invite them or did Mnuchin invite them? Is this a move by Mnuchin and the bankers as a follow-up to this increased pressure this past week to keep the talk going here, to maneuver Trump and the Boltons and the Lighthizers? Well, it could be. Of course, we won't know who really invited the Chinese. Was it Mnuchin or was it Trump? But, you know, Trump comes out and says he's going to impose the $200 billion. He said he doesn't care if there's no deal with China. That's what he said here last couple of days, right? So he's expressing the hardline military faction position here. We'll see whether he goes ahead, right? Whether this is just a reflection of pressure from U.S. trade groups and bankers that Trump is just going along with tokenly here. Is this a move by Trump to make it look like he's not opposed to a deal with China, a trade deal with China, to reduce the pressure from these groups before the election? Well, is he preparing the ground for the next tariff move, the $200 billion? Or will he back off of it at the last minute? Or is there a trade deal being worked here that will be announced right before the November elections? An October surprise, huh? China with Canada and Mexico. In other words, announce them all. Here we look what I've done here right before the election. Well, it could be any and all of those things. It could be just Trump doing his deference thing to the U.S. military. You know, that's what a draft dodger does. That's what he was, right? Rich guy, got out of Vietnam, right? And now he just kissing ass with the military. He loves the military, right? Okay. Well, you know, a parenthetical development here related, very interesting, was that Trump got in a pissing match yesterday with the CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, Jamie Dimon. Yeah, Dimon got interviewed, and he threw a zinger at Trump, saying that he was smarter than Trump, and he made his money. It wasn't given to him by his daddy. Well, was that a slip-up by Dimon, or was that coordinated and expressed the bankers' discontent with Trump here and that he might blow this great deal for the bankers of access to China that they want? Well, interesting, right? A cat fight, verbal cat fight. Trump you know, tweeted right back with a nasty tweet here. And so, you know, like two high school sophomores here, these guys are duking it out over emails, well, tweets in this case, right? Yeah. Interesting development here with Diamond versus Trump. And Trump's move here is flip-flop. What does this all mean here with inviting the Chinese over? Now, the Chinese aren't going to fall for anything. I think the Chinese are going to wait until after the November elections and see what actually opens up. If Trump gets trounced, I think the bankers and Mnuchin and others are going to reassert themselves even more strongly. If Trump comes out ahead and doesn't get trounced, you know, his supporters in Congress in the November elections, well, then I think the Chinese will go to Plan B and see what they can get from Trump. Okay. Political machinations going on here with the November elections, which are always a big element in all this trade stuff. All right, another important, interesting global development was Turkey. You know, Turkey is sort of the point of the spear at this growing emerging market instability and collapse of currencies going on. Their currency collapsed 50%, 40% only. Argentina was more than 50%. And great pressure on Turkey by the international finance community to raise interest rates to prevent capital flight. You know, when your currency collapses that much, holders of the currency both within and outside of Turkey want to dump those currencies and exchange them for dollars, which are rising. And that's what's been going on, dumping lira, Turkish lira, their currency, for dollars. And a lot of pressure on Erdogan, who's the president over there in Turkey, to do something. And what the bankers want him to do is to raise interest rates. You know, and Erdogan doesn't want to raise interest rates because raising interest rates would slow his economy. And he's in the middle of this fight domestically to keep economic growth going. You know, Turkey financed a lot of its economic growth by borrowing dollars from the West, from European banks and U.S. banks. It's dollarized debt. And when the dollar rises, the cost of the debt rises. And how do you pay for dollars? Debt, dollarized debt. Well, you got to sell more exports to earn dollars in order to pay the dollarized debt. So you got to sell more exports as your debt rises. But the global economy is slowing. Trade is slowing, so it becomes even more difficult. Well, you know what the Western bankers want is raise interest rates. Erdogan here. Stop the capital flight outflow as your currencies collapse, right? And by the way, as the currency collapses, inflation rises as well. I think inflation in Turkey is well over 20%, in some places 40%. So it was just announced the Turkish Central Bank raised interest rates from 18% to 24%. Well, that's still a lot lower than Argentina, that raised its interest rates to 60%. Well, it shut down that whole economy. Depression not coming. It exists in Argentina, and it's going to get much worse. Right? You see, these guys, these bankers and central bankers, they just want to protect the value of the investments of the rich folks. That's all. And that's why they're willing to raise these interest rates. Well, that just causes mass unemployment and layoffs. And that's what's happening in Argentina, but it's happening also in Turkey to some extent, not as great. Well, Erdogan is upset because, in his view, and he's not wrong, this kind of central bank bankers raising interest rates is a form of exploitation, as he calls it. And he's not incorrect in that. Right? So what's going to happen in Turkey is going to be interesting here. Well, Erdogan, who is already making moves to take over the central bank, and, you know, the bankers in the West are saying, oh, central bank independence. You got to have central bank independence. The politicians can't take over the central bank. It's got to do whatever it does without political influence of politicians and government. Well, central banks are never independent. It's just who they're dependent on or with. politicians or the bankers? Well, it's the bankers who really run the central banks. In the U.S., it's a very sophisticated, opaque process that I've described in my book, Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, last year. And that's true everywhere. Okay. You saw it very clearly in Europe and Greece and places like that. Okay. So, you know, what happens is going to be interesting with Turkey here in the coming weeks. Will Erdogan take over the central bank and assert control over that part of the economy? You know, capitalists make sure that the monetary side of the economy is not subject to sovereign public influence and control. No, it's too important. You know, the price of their money? No, interest rates, the price of their money? No, no. You can't leave this to politicians elected by the people, because if that happens, well, who knows what's going to happen to our money? Hmm? By the way, in the postscript to my book, I have a proposal for a constitutional amendment that will democratize the Federal Reserve, the central bank, make it an elected institution, you know, rather than an institution that's controlled by the heads of the key committees in the Senate and the House, who are always buddies of the bankers, who provide them great campaign contributions and other lobbying goodies. Mm. Okay, so Turkey, we'll watch Turkey. You know, now that they raised their interest rate 24%, it stopped the collapse of their currency. But it's only temporary, you see, only temporary, because Turkey has this massive dollar debt that has to be paid. And the dollar will keep rising, and the cost of the servicing principal interest will continue to rise. And Turkey just does not have sufficient export earnings in order to pay that principal and interest, especially as it rises. Mm. Very key development here. And we'll get back to later today in the show, talking about contagion across financial markets and how it looks like it's the contagion is occurring globally here in the currency markets, the foreign exchange markets, and it's beginning to spill over into the stock markets as well. But we'll come back to that. All right. Another interesting development I want to mention here is the U.S. Commerce Department, the Census, U.S. Census Agency of the Commerce Department, came out with a report on median incomes, median family incomes in the U.S. And the bottom line of the report was that real median family income has risen 1.8% here the past year, 1.8% in real terms, adjusted for inflation. Right. Now, as you know, in previous recent shows, I've been talking about the myth of rising wages. And in fact, if you haven't read it, I suggest you go to my blog and read that blog piece of about a week or so ago, which has appeared in several different blogs as well, ZNet and Global Research and others. So take a look at that, because I debunk this argument that hourly wages are rising. In fact, they're still declining. Now, that's hourly wages. That's different than income. Most workers, vast majority of workers, you know, their income is basically their wages, their wage income. They might have you know, a little supplement if their minimum pay in terms of food stamps as a source of income, or earned income tax credit as a source of income, transfer payments of different kinds, you know, that might play a role as well. But for the median family, it's their wage rate times the number of hours they work. Income is not wages. Wages is a big part of income at the median, but also how many hours they work. So when it says median income has risen 1.8%, that means maybe the hourly wage hasn't risen, but they're working more hours, you see. So don't confuse the median income with wages. Now, this 1.8% is an overestimation as well. Why is that? Well, what if these wages, I mean hours of work, and the wages, it's wages times hours of work, plus some transfer payments, which are minimal. What if this median income is concentrated to the upper end of wage earners? What if it's concentrated? You know, that means that you got a bias to the upper end, as I argued, tech workers, you know, and workers on the coast and so forth, workers, you know, on healthcare and et cetera. So it's skewed to the high end. Wages are skewed to the high end. Okay, but this is median, right? This is median. It's not high end. Well, the explanation of 1.8% may lie in total hours worked. It may lie in the fact that people are working second jobs. That could be the explanation here. More hours worked. Gig jobs. More than ever before. They may be getting more overtime pay, or they may be getting, you know, more transfer payments. Social Security went up this year for the first time in a long time, several years, right? So the 1.8% adjusted for inflation may reflect more, or even totally, the extra hours of work and not wage increases. And by the way, you know, if it's extra hours of work, those extra hours can disappear in a month. Unlike if it's a wage increase, it becomes, you know, institutionalized in your pay structure. Also, 1.8% adjusted for inflation. Inflation is underestimated in the U.S., as I argued in that article, for various reasons, because they smooth out the consumer price index now, what's called chain pricing, and they assume product quality increases, actually reducing in what they report as inflation. And there's a number of assumptions that go into the government statisticians estimating inflation. Inflation is significantly higher than the 2.9%. Well, if it's higher than 2.9%, and I say it's about 3.5, then this 1.8% median income gain is a misrepresentation. It should be maybe 1% median income gain. And keep in mind, you know, those below the median are probably definitely, in my estimations, going backwards in terms of wages. We've also talked in recent weeks about ideology in economics, how it works. And my previous discussions were about how ideology, which is misrepresentation of reality consciously to the benefit of certain interests, it's not making a mistake. It's not an error. It's a conscious, purposeful misrepresentation. And I've in previous shows talked about how this was done, the techniques, language games that are played to change the meaning of propositions, statements, theories, models, and so forth. I'm not going to go over that today, but I will say that with government statistics, we also have an element of ideology and misrepresentation going on. Just very briefly, using this example of median incomes in the Census Bureau, right? I mentioned how inflation is underestimated, consumer price inflation, and this is done by primarily using the chained index pricing, as they call it, which simply smooths out and averages inflation from year to year. It's an arbitrary thing that's done that reduces the level of the inflation rate. And that's a typical technique, of course, also what's called adjusting for quality and hedonic pricing. And the economics talk here that I'll just briefly mention and go over, right? Well, there's other ways as well. One of the major techniques of ideology is to delete important phrases and meanings from propositions and theories. Well, you can do the same from the data itself. You can delete certain data from the calculations. As I said in my article about the myth of wages here, what's deleted here is what about the lack of no wages altogether for people who lose their jobs? Maybe adjusted for unemployment insurance if they get it, a transfer, you know. But when you lose a job, you got no wage. Well, why isn't that total wage elimination factored into changes in the national wage rates? It should be. It's a total reduction in wages. And then I also mentioned in the article about what about deferred wages and social wages? What are those? Well, deferred wages are wages that are, instead of putting in your paycheck, is put into your pension fund. That's a deferred wage. And if pension payments are reduced, which they're chronically being done here in defined benefit pension plans as those plans go under, well, then that deferred wage should be factored into the total wage. And then we have social wage, and that's Social Security payments. Now, that should be factored in if Social Security in real terms is not adjusted upward for inflation adequately. Well, there's lots of ways that certain kinds of wages are left out. And there's also a bias in the wage numbers because, believe it or not, what's considered wages in the U.S. national income accounts is 65% of all the profits of non-corporate business owners. Yes, 65% is considered wage. So, you know, that biases wages to the upside. You know, that those are profits. Come on, that's business income is profits. It's not wages, just like corporate profits. Why did they do that? Well, decades ago when they established the national income accounts, GDP sometimes called, they just made that arbitrary assumption that 65% of all proprietors, business owners, profits were considered wages. Well, that biases wages to the upside because profits of proprietors have been rising rapidly, especially with the Trump tax cuts, and therefore should be considered profits. You see, by doing that, by assuming 65% of proprietors' profits are really wages, you reduce the profits totals while you increase the wage totals. So makes it look like profits aren't as big as they actually are. It makes it look like wages are bigger than they actually are. These are games. These are language games in a form of statistical assumptions and analyses and data gathering here. You know, just another egregious example is rents. Rents are income of sort. But if you own your home, you're not paying a rent, right? You may not even be paying a mortgage. You may have your house paid off. Well, the government assumes that 2/3 of your mortgage payment is a rent. You're paying rent to yourself. Now, that's ridiculous. Yeah? But that's what they assume. The government statistics are full of these arbitrary, absurd assumptions that change the meanings and definitions of wages and rents and profits and everything. So you got to be suspicious, and you got to understand the small print and how they define some of these things. And that goes for U.S. Census Bureau data on median incomes as much as it goes for the myth of real hourly wages rising as well. Okay, so having said that, let's talk about emerging markets, right? And the contagion effects across emerging markets, which we're beginning to see now. Why are emerging markets so important? Because it's a globalized economy. And what happens in one sector has repercussions, reverberates to other sectors of the economy globally. And what we can say about the global economy today, not only is trade slowing down as a percentage of global GDP and in general, but what we're seeing is a growing imbalance between what's going on in the U.S. and what's going on in the rest of the world. Not just emerging markets, but other key sectors of the global economy like Europe, Northeast Asia, i.e. Japan, and South Korea, Taiwan, right? And, of course, emerging markets themselves. The major emerging markets, is China an emerging market? It's probably more properly considered an advanced economy now. But other emerging markets, you know, in Latin America, in Asia, in the Middle East, you know, I'm talking about the Brazils, the South Africas, Indonesias, Indias, even Australia and economies. You know, emerging economies like that. Okay. What we're seeing, of course, is the initial stages of this contagion beginning to occur. Now, contagion in financial markets is very important because that's how financial crises are propagated, how they spread from one to the other more deeply. And cause a more generalized financial crisis like we saw in 2007, 2008, 2009. Okay, well, at the leading edge is Turkey and Argentina. Their currencies are collapsing. Now, currencies, foreign exchange, you know, is a financial market. There are global markets for foreign exchange. You can go buy and sell whatever currency you want. And, of course, they're all exchangeable for the dollar. The global reserve and trading currency, right? And exchange rates between currencies are always one currency to the other currency. So if the dollar goes up, the Argentine peso must go down, and vice versa. If the Argentine peso goes up, the dollar in exchange to the dollar goes down. Now, that might be different in an exchange ratio between the peso and the euro, but the U.S. dollar is the key currency. And as it goes, all the other currencies respond. So when the Argentine peso collapses, why is it collapsing? Well, fundamentally, it's collapsing because the dollar's going up. Why is the dollar going up? Because interest rates are being raised by the Federal Reserve. They really went up today, by the way. Well, why are interest rates going up? Because the Fed has decided it's got to somehow finance Trump's multi-trillion dollar deficits and debt that's coming. That's how you pay for it. You sell treasury bonds around the world and in the U.S. to raise the money to cover the deficit. And why do we have a deficit? Trump tax cuts. Trump war spending going up, tax cuts going way down, you know, trillions of dollars, as I've argued and showed. And by the way, just an aside, this move in Congress is gaining steam to provide yet another tax cut for corporations and the wealthy before the November elections here, just in case they lose control of one or more of the houses. You know, they want to ram this through. Another officially $681 billion in tax cuts for the wealthy by extending them, the Trump tax cuts, extending them permanently, you see. The Trump tax cuts last year, which I've argued are $5 trillion and not $1.5 trillion, offset by raising taxes on the middle classes and making absurd assumptions about economic growth for the next decade. That's how they get from $5 trillion to $1.5 trillion that they report in the press. That's ideology, by the way, as well. Okay? Misrepresentation of reality, the essential definition of ideology in economics. Okay, so they're trying to make it all permanent. You see, when they passed the Trump tax cut last December, the Republicans and Mitch McConnell had to pull a trick here in the Senate in order to push it through on a simple majority vote. They had to not make it permanent because there's laws about offsetting. You have to offset tax cuts with spending cuts and vice versa. And he didn't do that, okay? And in order to get away with not doing that, they made the Trump tax cuts only through 2027. Okay, and that's how they did and run around the Democrats and got it passed in the Senate. Democrats couldn't stop it, okay? So now they're coming back for a second bite at that apple, and what they're saying, the Republicans and McConnell and others, right? The saying is, well, now we can simply extend it and we don't have to go through that maneuver, right? They knew they were going to do this all along, you see. They pulled that maneuver just to get it established, and now they come back and they pass it, you know, permanently, make it permanent, you know, reduce that alternative minimum tax, reduce the estate tax, reduce the tax rates and so forth on the rich permanently. And it's going to be another $1 trillion. Well, you know, that's on top of the $5 trillion already. What? You know, give or take $1 trillion, what the hell, right? All right, so the Fed has to continue raising interest rates, and it really is doing so. But as I've argued many times, the Fed can't raise it much higher. You know, maybe another quarter, half, you know, the federal funds rate, which is the Fed benchmark rate, all other interest rates move in direction of that, you know, at 2% now. They can maybe get two more quarter percent rate hikes to 250, 2.5. But if it goes any higher than that, they will precipitate a credit crunch and therefore a recession. And the crisis in emerging markets will really get bad. We see already at only 2% federal funds rate what's happening in emerging markets. Well, if you raise it another a half or three quarters of a full percent, you know, it's 2.75 or something, that means the other interest rates are going to go to 4 and 5%. And that's going to devastate the emerging markets. You're going to have a collapse in emerging market economies. We're already seeing the weakest emerging markets collapsing, their currencies collapsing, Argentina, Turkey, and now it's spreading. We're seeing contagion going from those economies in that example over to other economies. The Brazilian real currency over 20% devalued. South African rand, Indonesian rupiah, India rupee, Philippines peso, even Australian dollar. Right, they're all declining fairly fast. And if you raise your interest rates, further fast, they're going to decline even more. Right. So currency contagions beginning to occur across markets, across money markets, foreign exchange markets. But now we're also beginning to see the early signs of currency price devaluation spilling over to stock markets in those countries. Right? Well, if the currency is devaluing and they're raising interest rates to 60%, like worst case Argentina, you're going to leave your money in stocks? Well, the stock market is going to go down and you're going to lose asset value. So no one's going to leave their money in the stock market in Argentina or Turkey eventually here soon. No, they're going to pull it out, and they're going to go to cash, and they're going to go to cash in dollars or yen or even euros, you see. And that's beginning to happen. Even in China, where the devaluation's only been 10%, look what's happened to Chinese stock markets. The Shanghai market, the main market there, is down over 25%. That's a major, major correction. The Hang Seng in Hong Kong, secondary, is down 15%. And you can see the same things happening in Indonesia, in Brazil, and all these other economies that are next to fall. After Argentina and Turkey here, well, they're already fallen. South Africa, Brazil, right? And on the cusp here, Indonesia, Philippines, maybe even India, right? So we're beginning to see a contagion across financial asset markets. You see, money, currency, is a financial asset. It's a highly liquid financial asset, but it's a financial asset. And, of course, equities are a financial asset. And once you get a deep contraction in one financial asset market, it tends to reverberate to other financial markets. It's the price system that is the transmission mechanism across these financial asset markets. Government policies do the same. Investors' psychology, they hold investments, in foreign exchange, in stocks, in bonds, and so forth. And as they pull back from one or experience losses in one market, in this case foreign exchange, they got to cover it by their holdings in other financial markets. So they sell there. And of course, that causes the prices in these other financial markets to decline as well. And then if you've got insurance contracts called derivatives and bets called derivatives on the volatility of these financial asset markets, then those begin to become volatile and decline as well. So financial asset contagion naturally occurs across financial asset markets when you have a deep and rapid decline in one of the markets. It will spill over to the others, and we're seeing it spilling over already to China. Now, the question in other markets, and from stocks, then it spills over into bond markets. And then, lock the door, because the bond market's the biggie, and the bond markets have the biggest impact. So if you get instability in the bond markets, if equity markets, stock markets collapse and it causes a contraction in the bond markets, then, you're in deep trouble globally. Right? Remember subprime market bonds, 2007-08, the bond market, right? It decline was exacerbated, the derivatives markets. You see, 2008, it appears to be a subprime mortgage bond crash, but that only precipitated. The real crash was in the derivatives that underlay, that were written on all those subprime mortgages, and the derivatives that the other financial institutions and banks were holding and issuing on each other. Let's talk about that. This is the anniversary here tomorrow, September 15th, the 10th anniversary of the collapse of Lehman Brothers. Remember that? Lehman Brothers? Yeah. 10th anniversary. Can it happen again? Well, yes. Not the same way, though. Right? It's not going to be a subprime mortgage real estate property precipitated a financial crisis. Not this time. It's going to be something else. Then we'll talk about something else. There's the candidates for something else. Right? But in the case of Lehman Brothers, it was the derivatives. You see, when Henry Paulson, the Secretary of the Treasury, an ex-Goldman Sachs investment bank CEO who took over the Treasury 2 years before, you see, he decided he let Lehman Brothers go under. Lehman Brothers could have been saved. There's a good book just came out, and I'm reading some reviews of it by Lawrence Ball, an economist, talking about what really happened at Lehman Brothers. Read it, because he's got it right. He's got it right. And what really happened in Lehman Brothers is that Henry Paulson let it go under. After he bailed out Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, right, and after the Federal Reserve bailed out Bear Stearns 6 months earlier, Paulson decided to let Lehman Brothers go under. Well, why did he do that? Well, you know, you read his book and Ben Bernanke's book and so forth. They got their cover stories. But this is what I believe happened, right? Goldman Sachs had written tens of billions, I think it was $69 billion, tens of billions of dollars of credit default swap derivatives on Lehman Brothers, meaning they bet that Lehman Brothers would go under. Where did they buy these CDSs? They bought it from AIG, the biggest global insurance company in the world at the time. AIG issued all of these credit default swaps, which are just insurance contracts, right? It's a derivative, and was making a lot of money issuing all these derivatives that it couldn't cover if the crisis ever happened. Of course, it did happen, but it raked in the money on derivatives. But Goldman Sachs bought billions and billions of CDSs, betting that Lehman would collapse. And what's the connection? Well, their former CEO, Henry Paulson, right, let Lehman collapse. Goldman Sachs, which would have been in trouble otherwise, made a potload of money off of the CDSs it bought from AIG on Lehman collapsing. Of course, AIG got stuck holding the bag, right? Well, within a week, Henry Paulson turns around and bails out AIG. He wouldn't bail out Lehman. Goldman got rich off of that. But he made AIG good. How much? Well, the estimates are between $85 and $180 billion. The government bailed out AIG, gave him the money. Yeah, so they could turn around and pay Goldman Sachs, you see? Bankers are cannibals. They eat themselves. They eat their colleagues. They eat each other, right? Same thing happened 6 months earlier in Bear Stearns. Well, who was financing Bear Stearns? Another investment bank, fifth largest at the time. Well, J.P. Morgan Chase was financing Bear Stearns. In other words, these investment banks, shadow banks, whenever they needed extra money, and because they would lend all their money out, you know, not just subprimes, everywhere else, because there's no regulations say they had to keep any reserves, they would borrow from the commercial banks like J.P. Morgan. J.P. Morgan was a big financier of Bear Stearns. Well, J.P. Morgan decided in February of 2008 not to loan Bear Stearns any more money, and that meant Bear Stearns went under. It collapsed in March. Well, who bailed out Bear Stearns? The Federal Reserve. Well, not directly. It didn't bail out Bear Stearns and let it survive. It gave a $29 billion loan to J.P. Morgan, which didn't need it, but it gave the money to Morgan to buy Bear Stearns. And Morgan scooped up Bear Stearns for pennies on the dollar. Pennies. I mean, Bear Stearns is, as I said before, it's downtown New York high-rise building was worth $100 billion alone, let alone all the other assets, you see. So the Fed, the government, arranged the takeover and gave the money to J.P. Morgan to scoop up Bear Stearns. Well, couldn't the Fed have just given the money, the loan, directly to Bear Stearns? Sure, right? Or, you know, some other solution to keep Bear Stearns afloat rather than giving Bear Stearns for free almost to J.P. Morgan Chase? Well, Chase has more political influence in the government, of course, right? Well, the same thing happened with Lehman 6 months later, except Lehman didn't get bailed out either. And they didn't. Goldman wouldn't buy Lehman. It should have arranged something. You know, why couldn't the Fed or the Treasury? By the way, the Treasury did the Lehman Brothers because the Fed said we've used all our money, all our liquid funds here, bailing out Bear Stearns and all the others. We're broke, so you, the Treasury, have to take over. And Paulson did do that. And why couldn't Paulson have arranged some TARP money for Lehman Brothers? He could have. But it was more profitable for Goldman Sachs, you see. Far more profitable. And, you know, his buddies over there at Goldman Sachs. Now, read the Lawrence Ball book, you know. All kinds of excuses, you know, in the autobiographies of Henry Paulson and Ben Bernanke and Geithner and others, you know, about what actually happened. But both the Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers, kind of like bookends to the banking crisis of 2008, you know, the government plays a key role in the crisis, in precipitating the crisis, the U.S. government, by partnering with these big banks, J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs, you know, and allowing these banks to be scooped up or bought off or fail and, you know, collect the CDS payments from AIG, and then bail out AIG, you see. Yeah, they're cannibals. Bankers are cannibals. They eat their own. Yeah, they don't care. Right? They don't care the consequences. But the point here is the government played a key role in all this crash. The U.S. government, the Federal Reserve, and the Treasury are significantly responsible for what happened and the cost of what happened. They should have gone to jail too, you know. Bernanke and Paulson should be in jail, right along with, you know, Fold, who ran the Lehman Brothers and the others. But none of them went to jail. Not one. Yeah. Okay. So that's a little bit of a history here, you know, you might want to keep in mind for the 10th anniversary of the Lehman Brothers crash. You know, how much of it was really engineered by the banks themselves with the cooperation of the U.S. government? Significantly, I think. Significant. Of course, we all paid the price, you know. 14 million homes went into foreclosure, yeah, and they weren't bailed out. You know, the banks that held the mortgages were bailed out, but the homeowners weren't. Thank you, Mr. Obama. You know, the Fed spent $6 trillion bailing out the banks and investors who had bought subprime mortgages. $6 trillion, not four and a half, six. You know? How much did they spend to help the homeowners? $25 billion is all Obama allocated. $25 billion to bail out homeowners. And most of that was payments to Bank of America and Citigroup and some of the others to lower their interest rates, their mortgage rates and servicing costs for new homeowners. In other words, get the existing homeowners out of those homes and make it easier for new people to buy up their homes. Well, that's not a bailout. And that's one reason why people are so pissed off here about that recovery under Obama. Yeah. Okay. So what's different this time around, we might ask? Well, another crisis is coming. I'm saying 2019-20, right? And it's going to be worse because now there's even more debt out there, and it's non-financial corporate debt, household debt, and government debt. $20 trillion more debt in the U.S. today than in 2008. And globally, $250 trillion in total debt as opposed to $178 trillion back in 2007. So the debt problem has not gone away. As soon as prices start falling again, you're going to see even greater crisis. Fiscal monetary policy, zero interest rates for 7 years, subsidized the banks, subsidized corporations. They were able to issue corporate bonds, i.e. debt, $1 trillion a year. And now we are in a situation where instead of monetary policy, we're using tax cuts for corporations and investors to subsidize them. Well, we got a problem here, though, and that is, you know, interest rates, not much ammunition there. Federal spending, not much ammunition there with $1 trillion deficits coming. So the solutions is going to be even tougher next time, right? We got internal splits and fights among the elites in the U.S. and globally. We got more popular discontent, right and left. We have an accelerating decline of democratic institutions. We got bubbles again in stock and bond markets and derivative markets. We have a collapse of central policy agreements. Social democracy has collapsed everywhere. It's going to be worse in terms of response. We're not as prepared for the response. Okay, in the last minute here, let me just say one thing here. Moving on to Trump. Trump is being cornered, right? Not just by the Mueller, but by other sectors of businesses, business class, and so forth. It's a dangerous period, right? He's already planning distractions, coups in Venezuela, Nicaragua, and Brazil if the Workers' Party comes back there. Syria, Iran, military ventures are on the agenda, right? He'll pardon himself and others, right? If Mueller and Congress come out with a statement here or an indictment of sorts. And if the Democrats take the House, there will be impeachment proceedings, right? So all of this will put him in a corner, and this guy is volatile and unpredictable. We don't know what is going to happen, but it certainly won't stabilize the economy once it does. But watch for the October surprise and settlements here, exaggerated by Trump, with Mexico, Canada, maybe even China. 50-50 chance of the latter, not guaranteed, but watch closely. Okay, that's Alternative Visions for today. Now.